And we are now joined by the KYMN National Security Correspondent, Commander John Olson, retired of the U.S. Navy. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well this morning, gentlemen. How about yourselves?
Doing well.
Wait, hang on. There we go. I forgot to turn Ryan's microphone on. I apologize.
Doing well, John. How are you today?
I'm good.
Good.
So, John, you and I were talking last night about what our topic should be today, and you sent me an article. I'm not familiar with this with this publication that you sent me. What on earth is going on there? Okay, not familiar with the article or the publication you sent me, but it's a really interesting article about the preparedness of the United States military to fight a war in the Pacific, and the measures the military is taking to figure out exactly how prepared they are. It's one simple question today.
Okay.
Is the military training hard enough and doing enough to be ready if the unthinkable happens and we have to go to war with China?
So that is the, $100 billion question, right?
Yep.
That's a question that the military asks itself on a regular basis. It should be the kind of question that our political leadership is asking the military on a regular basis. Obviously, the military serves under civilian political leadership, so ultimately it rests on the shoulders of our political leaders to decide whether or not the military is up to snuff, ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I would tell you that for successive presidential administrations now, if you go back to the Obama and second Obama administration, the first Trump administration, throughout the Biden administration, there were deep concerns. Are we actually ready to deal with a rapidly rising China and the People's Liberation Army, as it's called?
Mm-hmm.
PLA has multiple branches, the People's Liberation Army Air Force, the Navy, the ground forces, the rocket forces, etc. So we've watched there's been pretty good reporting in the press and the unclassified stuff about China's rise and the expansion of their Air Force and their Navy and training that their ground forces do and mm-hmm. creation of regional commands that they have that mimic, sort of what we do, but we do it on a global basis. They focus it more just on their own territory and then the areas where they believe that they need to project power and control those areas, like the South China Sea as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. military has been trying to return back to the idea of being fully prepared to fight a full-scale conventional war. Obviously, after the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, the idea of fighting a major theater conventional war in Europe sort of went away because the Soviet Union really kind of collapsed and the Warsaw Pact had collapsed 2 years before that. So 9/11 in 2001 sort of changed the entire trajectory of things where we weren't fighting a major conventional war, but we were definitely fighting all over the world trying to defeat Salafist jihadi terror groups, right?
Right.
That's a fairly simple thing, relatively speaking, for a big military to do. Counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, what makes it hard is not whether or not you have the military combat capability. It's whether or not you can divide the people from the terrorists or the insurgents. And that's a completely different kind of a conflict.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Pacific theater, the Indo-Pacific, as we refer to it now, because that's a little bit more accurate if you think about the scale of this problem. China has been working on projecting power and getting better and better at pushing forces out in what's called the first island chain. Do you guys know what that means, the first island chain?
I do not.
So if you go from southern Japan down through, the Ryukyu chain to Taiwan and then sort of down to Manila
mm-hmm.
Or down to the Philippines and then across over to Vietnam, okay. that that the Spratly region, that's essentially what's considered the first island chain.
Okay.
And that's a concept, a defense concept that the U.S. has had going all the way back really to the Eisenhower administration, trying to think about how do you contain, the People's Republic of China. And then you have, you know, multiple island chains that, go out beyond that. The second island chain takes you out to essentially Guam in the Northern Mariana Islands, and wraps around. And the third island chain really takes you all the way to kind of Hawaii.
Right. Okay.
So as we think about these three island chains, what you really want to do is contain Chinese military power within that first island chain. And if you look at a map of the Western Pacific, the linchpin in that whole deal is Taiwan, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's an enormous mass of land, literally, 100 miles off the coast of China, of mainland China. It is a democracy. It is a place where true capitalism is the functioning economic model, et cetera. So if you think about, I mean, those, your listeners who are students of World War II will understand when I talk about this, but the Pacific Theater in World War II, there were two things that were absolutely critical to American success in that fight. One is understanding what we call the tyranny of time and distance. Okay. I mean, the Pacific Ocean is enormous, yes. Right? It's absolutely enormous. To get from Hawaii to Taiwan is 5,200 miles.
Wow.
I mean, think about how long of a journey that is when you're steaming ahead at 15 knots on a U.S. Navy ship. That takes a while to get there.
Yeah.
So that tyranny of time of distance is... How soon do you need to issue orders if you're the president of the United States to get the entire U.S. military moving in the direction of supporting our allies in Japan or South Korea or dealing with a Chinese invasion of Taiwan? It takes a long time to get combat power moved from the United States forward, or even places where we have forward basing, like in Japan and South Korea, and now in the Philippines and all the way down in Australia. You still have to load that combat power and get it somewhere where it can be effective in dealing with Chinese aggression. The second piece to that is the idea that, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics.
Yes.
So it's one thing to put combat power into position to fight, say, Chinese forces. Or North Korean forces, as an example. But the bigger problem is, how do you move the supply chain fast enough that you can keep those forces that are engaged with the enemy fully supplied with literally everything they need? More bullets, blood plasma, fuel for their vehicles, repair parts for their vehicles, replacement parts, etc. All of these things matter. And that's one of the things that the military has always done very, very well is the logistics piece. There is a reason why military logisticians, when they decide to retire or leave the military, get snapped up by commercial companies all over the place, like the day they leave the military, because they truly are experts on how to do all those things. So what's been going on in the Indo-Pacific theater, we divide the world up in the U.S. military into theater combatant commands. And the Indo-Pacific theater is almost invariably commanded by a U.S. Navy four-star admiral. Okay. And the reason for that is obvious. I mean, if you look at the Indo-Pacific theater, it is the huge ocean that must be defended. So you put a Navy guy in there. And I would tell you, going all the way back, to the Obama administration, moving through the Trump administration and into the Biden administration, there was a recognition that we needed to get far more effective at moving lots of forces from all of the different U.S. military services, Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and now the Space Force. Mm-hmm. How do you move those forces effectively to get them in position to defend American national security interests? But also, how do you integrate all of the command and control? How do you integrate intelligence support? How do you integrate logistics? How do you do all of those things so it's a very realistic, what we refer to in the military as a rehearsal, to be prepared to defend, you know, whatever the national security challenges that's identified by our political leadership. So in the Indo-Pacific theater, they've been ramping up over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, how we think about the threats from, say, China or China and Russia or China, Russia and North Korea. How do you think about those challenges? And then how do you start running joint exercises between the different service components, like the Navy and the Air Force working together? Then the Navy, the Air Force, Space Force, and Army working together. How do you integrate the Marines into amphibious operations? You know, all those kinds of things. So we are moving in that direction now. And then U.S. Navy, the theater combatant commander, is talking about doing big scale, large scale operations across the Indo-Pacific, not just with U.S. forces, but also in our allies, like the Japanese self-defense forces, the South Koreans, the Aussies, even our allies that are over in Europe want to move forward. The Royal Navy, the French Navy, et cetera, even the Germans, they want to move forces into the Pacific theater to train in a combined exercise with U.S. military forces. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's got to be, I mean, that's got to be one of the biggest exercises that the U.S. has been a part of in maybe ever.
Well, no, I mean, we have done what's called Reforger is the name of the exercise that's been done for many, many decades over in Europe, as an example.
Okay.
And that was done during the Cold War. You know, let's say the Soviets punch across into Western Europe. How do you get U.S. combat power en masse over to Europe very quickly to defend Eastern Europe? So that concept has been around for a while. Reforger exercises took on a little bit of a new urgency over the last few years. The European command ran a similar kind of exercise after Russia had invaded Ukraine, where we brought together a bunch of the NATO allies and practiced. I mean, it was like 100,000 troops or something like that involved in it. So the exercises that are being done in the Indo-Pacific theater now are trying to integrate all these combat capabilities, the command and control systems, the logistics, et cetera, so that we are – I mean, it's one thing to do war gaming on a map, right, like right. a game.
Yep.
It's another thing entirely when you have to give orders in real time to huge numbers of forces that are on the move and have to – you know, conquer the tyranny of time and distance over you know, the great distances involved in the Pacific. And I would tell you also that, you know, some of the things that are educating the U.S. military and our allies right now as we develop these rehearsal exercises in the Indo-Pacific, there was an awful lot of information that was learned about the fight that we've been dealing with the Houthis in the Red Sea. Firing, you know, live munitions to shoot down Houthi-launched ballistic missiles and drones and cruise missiles and all kinds of other stuff that they were given, you know, the Houthis were given by Iran. So the U.S. Navy has been in a long-term fight with the Houthis in Yemen to try and defend the Bab el-Mandeb Strait going from the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aden and out into the Indian Ocean. And it's real-time operations. It's lots of Navy ships out there. You've got the whole logistics piece to it. You've got to maintain those ships while they're in the fight. Make sure you're feeding the crew. There's lots of things you got to do with all at the same time. And not just there, but up, sitting in the Levant in the Eastern Med, protecting Israel from attacks directly by Iran. And that has happened a couple of times now where U.S. Navy ships were involved in that. U.S. Air Force fighter aircraft were over there helping Israeli forces, working with the Jordanians and whatnot, even the Saudis. So we learned a lot about what's been going on combat-wise, modern combat tactics with unmanned platforms and a mix of other threats, including ballistic missiles, because of the fight that Israel is in with Iran and Iran's proxies. So you learn those things, you learn about combat operations, and you try and apply those things to the threat that we face from China, say. We've also learned a lot from watching the Russians, the 800-pound gorilla, try to take over, you know, Ukraine, which is defended by a spider monkey. And the spider monkey kicked the living crap out of the 800-pound gorilla, mostly because, you know, they are a dedicated bunch. They love freedom and democracy, and they want a nation to remain sovereign. And the NATO alliance has given them a lot of weapons to help defend their nation. We don't really see that similar kind of a thing in the Western Pacific. Japan is very capable. South Korea is very capable. The Philippines is getting more and more capable all the time. The Philippines is working closely with Japan and the United States on basing privileges and, you know, combined training exercises. All these things are going on. Now, what I would tell you as well, China, having ramped up their military, you know, they're spending a lot on their military. Mm-hmm. And if you recall some of the shows that we did on the National Security This Week program, we covered the challenge of dealing with a China that decides to launch an attack on Taiwan or carry out operations in the South China Sea against, you know, the neighboring countries that are claiming parts of the Spratly Islands, for instance, or other parts of the South China Sea. We talked with lots of experts about that. And if you think about this, the hardest military operation there is is an amphibious assault, where you're going to cross a large body of water and put your combat troops ashore against an enemy force that is prepared to defend itself, right? I mean, if you think about the movie Saving Private Ryan, that's a great example of how hard it is to land, do an opposed landing on a beach against an enemy that's dug in. So in the case of China, the People's Liberation Army has never carried out a major amphibious assault of any kind. And in this case, you're talking about crossing, you know, 75 to 100 nautical miles of open ocean through the Taiwan Strait and landing in a wildly heavily populated eastern side of Taiwan against a nation that has been preparing itself for decades to defend against a Chinese invasion. Now, one of the things that is concerning to me about this is that Taiwan has purchased lots and lots and lots of weapons from American defense companies. Mm-hmm. And we are, in some cases, 5 years or more behind in delivering those weapons to Taiwan so that they can defend themselves from a Chinese invasion. So all these exercises that are being planned right now, they would have been, you know, they would have been organized and scheduled 2 years ago, so that we had the resources in place and Congress had issued the money and the Department of Defense had been prepared to support all these things. So this is actually what you're about to see in the Western Pacific, really across the whole Pacific theater. Indo-Pacific theater is something that's been in the works that started during the Biden administration. It'll happen now during the Trump administration. And it's an important exercise that we need to start doing if we really want to deter China from trying to attack and seize Taiwan.
Okay. With just a couple of minutes left, I love these conversations because I have to ask one or two questions. It's just great.
And then he just goes.
Exactly. It has been, by my estimation, 80 years since the United States fought a full-scale naval war. Now, you're talking about the experience that we're getting in the Middle East and watching the Russians. But you're also talking about, you know, the Chinese have never in their history made an amphibious assault and landed troops. And it's been, well, since 1944, since the Americans basically did that. Does any of that matter? Like, obviously we have experts in the military who know and understand how to do this, but does the lack of practical experience with a full-scale naval war, does that make a difference in what we're talking about?
I would say yes, and I would say that the Indo-Pacific commander, the commander of Indo-PACOM, as it's referred to, these are Navy admirals. They're very aware of the fact that we have not exercised at a massive scale for a major theater war in a really long time. The Marine Corps still trains regularly for amphibious assault, mm-hmm. but it's usually smaller units like a battalion landing team. And what we're really talking about, if you look at something like Taiwan, you would have to move an entire Marine Expeditionary Force, right, a whole division of Marines out of Hamilton and get them over to Taiwan or someplace, you know, Okinawa, something along those lines. There's lots of different islands all over the place, the northern islands on the north side of the Philippines, the southern islands down the Ryukyu chain. I mean, there's lots of different places where you'd have to get Marines, maybe even ashore in Taiwan. The U.S. Army has something called the 18th Airborne Corps, which is made up of the 82nd and 101st. Those are both, you know, airborne or air assault kind of divisions. You got the 10th Mountain Division. Those are the kind of divisions that you'd move by air power as rapidly as you could, potentially putting them down in Taiwan so that you had the ability to bolster Taiwanese defense with Army ground combat power. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a war between the U.S. and China in the Indo-Pacific theater is primarily a no-kidding Navy and Air Force war, because we're really not going to put combat troops on mainland China. We're not going to invade, you know.
Please,
we're
no.
We're not going to invade mainland China. That's
please
just
don't
not
do that. No, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that would be terrible.
Yeah.
But the problem is, going to war with China today, if you think about the impact that tariffs are already having on the global economy and America's stock market and everything else, if we are so integrated with China, not just us, but so many other countries all around the world, including so many of our allies, a war with China would be the absolute dumbest thing we could do. Mm-hmm. If we can find a way through whatever our hangups are without going to war, that would be a much, much better solution.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's hope, right? And hope is not a course of action. You have to be prepared for the worst case scenario, which is why these big exercises are starting to take place in the Indo-Pacific theater. By the U.S. with our allies.
Okay, we have to call this one. But next week, we'll call this a three-part conversation about Taiwan. Because next week, what I want to ask you about is, you know, one of the things that I heard you say a million times on National Security this week is, you know, the economy is national security. I want to talk to you next week about, do these tariffs and especially what's happening between the U.S. and China, does it make a military conflict between these two countries, well, it probably makes it easier, but does it make it more likely? That's the question for next week, sir.
All right, I'll try and do my best.
Okay. Thanks, John, we appreciate it.
Yep.